as we start this message on Palm Sunday and thinking about Jesus entering into Jerusalem 2,000 or so years ago, I want you to know that where this message is going, as I was preparing it this week, it made me somewhat uncomfortable. And so if it makes you a little uncomfortable, especially as we get to the end, you're not alone, and that's okay. But if we are really going to authentically, honestly make this Holy Week journey with Jesus together, then we kind of need to go to some of these places and to listen to what Palm Sunday and the message of Palm Sunday really is about. What Jesus is really doing, and what some of the symbols involved and the actions that he takes, what significance those really have. Many of you, of course, have probably worn these bracelets or various paraphernalia with WWJD on them. Yeah, that's like kind of old school now. But, you know, some of you maybe back in like the early 2000s or the 90s, way back in the day, might have had those. And this morning, we need to ask that question. It's an important question to ask. It actually was from a book that was written way before that. And Christians for centuries and centuries and even millennia have been asking this question, what would Jesus do? And I think that the answer that we get on Palm Sunday when we watch Jesus enter into Jerusalem is that Jesus would get his hands dirty. What would Jesus do? Jesus would get his hands dirty. You see, Palm Sunday is not separate from the rest of Holy Week. When Jesus entered into Jerusalem, Jesus knew exactly what he was getting himself into. So the Gospel of Luke is really built around Jesus' journey to Jerusalem. Back in Luke 9, verse 51, Luke very specifically says, "Then Jesus set his face toward Jerusalem." And so the next 10 chapters are really framed with Jesus walking towards Jerusalem. And just 7 verses before Jesus sets his face towards Jerusalem, we're told this. "Let these words sink into your ears," Jesus says to his disciples. I want to listen. "Let these words sink into your ears. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into human hands." Jesus knows exactly what he's getting into when he goes into Jerusalem. And just a chapter before this, in Luke 18, verse 34, again, Jesus says this. "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and everything that is written about the Son of Man by the prophets will be accomplished." And his disciples were probably thinking, great. You know, everything that's been prophesied about the Messiah, how God is going to reign, and he's going to take down all of the enemies of Israel, they're thinking, great. But then Jesus says, "For he will be handed over to the Gentiles, and he will be mocked and insulted and spat upon. After they have flogged him, they will kill him, and on the third day he will rise again." Jesus knew exactly what he was getting into on Palm Sunday. And then in this story, we have this little moment where some of the Pharisees were told, said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell your disciples to stop." And sometimes we have these preconceived notions about the Pharisees. You know, they were these bad, evil guys, and some maybe were, but some we know also kind of had this affinity to Jesus. And I'm not sure these are necessarily the bad guys here in Luke 19, telling Jesus to get his disciples to stop. They might just as well be saying, "Look, if your disciples keep this up, you could be in some serious trouble as you enter into Jerusalem. This might not go well for you, so you might, in your best interest, want to get your disciples to stop." And of course, Jesus says, "Well, what's happening is happening." But Jesus knows what he's getting himself into. And then the first thing that Jesus does, according to Luke, when he enters into Jerusalem, is it says he came near and saw the city, and he wept over it. He wept. If you want a little more detail, go back to Luke 13, another time that Jesus weeps over Jerusalem. In chapter 13, verse 31, it says somewhere in chapter 13, it says, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, city that stones the prophets and murders the messengers sent to her. Jesus knows that this is what happens to prophets who enter into Jerusalem and stir things up. And that's just what Jesus does. He gets into Jerusalem and he starts stirring things up. Not only does he know what's going to happen, he actually does things that directly lead to his arrest and his impending death. He stirs up these crowds in the first place. These Galileans, probably, or people from the outskirts, from the backwoods of Israel, are coming in. And he stirs them up with some of these symbols of riding in on this donkey, and that had significance. And he does this, and the crowds are excited, and there's this fervor there. Now, the crowds think that Jesus, again, is probably coming in to do something other than what Jesus actually was coming in to do. But still, he's causing a little bit of a ruckus, and he allows it to happen. And Jesus also stirs up the Jewish authorities in Jerusalem, right? I mean, not only does he say, well, not only does he not stop his disciples and the crowds from cheering, and he says the stones would cry out if they were silent, but then he goes into Jerusalem, and what is the first thing he does after he weeps over it? He entered the temple and began to drive out those who were selling things there. And right after that, it says, every day he was teaching in the temple, the chief priests, the scribes, and the leaders of the people kept looking for a way to kill him. Stirring things up. They start questioning his authority in Luke 20, and they have all these traps and questions for him. And Jesus always responds in ways that kind of get under the skin of the Jewish authorities as well. And so he tells them this parable about the wicked tenants in chapter 20. And after he's done telling the parable, it says, when the scribes and chief priests realized that he had told this parable against them, they wanted to lay hands on him at that very hour. Jesus knows what he's doing. Not only that, he stirs up the crowds, he stirs up the Jewish authorities, he also stirs up the Romans in a sense too. Gives them fodder later on when the time comes for them to decide whether he will be killed or not. Ancient authorities tell us that around Passover time, Roman leaders, knowing that all of these Jews were coming into Jerusalem, making pilgrimages to Jerusalem, all of these Jews were coming into Jerusalem, and they had this religious fervor, they had this nationalistic fervor. They, over Passover, this is a feast that remembers the Exodus when God liberated his people. And so you can imagine that when all of these Jews get together for Passover each year, that there is this kind of nationalism of what God is going to do. And who were the oppressors now? Not the Egyptians, the Romans. And so the Romans, knowing that all of this stuff was going to be festering and bubbling up around Passover, they would make a show of their power, the power of Caesar. They would have a procession that marched into one side of the city with Roman guards and soldiers, and Pilate would have been coming in to the city at this time to say, hey, we know what's going on. You better watch yourselves. And so what does Jesus do? He has this other little procession, not of soldiers or anything, but of these peasants coming in on the other side of Jerusalem to the Passover feast, mimicking, almost mocking, in a sense, the Roman procession. Jesus gets into Jerusalem. He makes claims about himself that stir things up. He speaks words of truth to the powers that be and challenges them. And ultimately, Jesus even disappoints a lot of the very people who are cheering for him on that Palm Sunday. Everything that Jesus does and says leads to what happens on Maundy Thursday and Good Friday. Jesus, on Palm Sunday, is getting his hands dirty. He's going into a place that is not safe, and he's doing things that are not acceptable. And Jesus knows what he's getting himself into. So all of this then has to make us who call ourselves followers of Jesus or Christians or disciples or whatever we call ourselves, all of this has to make us think. what does it mean to follow Jesus into Jerusalem? You know, many of us have built our lives around staying clean, about being acceptable, about maintaining our dignity, and about staying safe. Think about all of the things that we do to maintain our quote-unquote cleanliness, our safety. And in many ways, in many places, we have built Christianity, a version of Christianity, that is about staying clean, keeping our hands clean, just not doing things that are unacceptable or might get us into trouble or might stir up something. Here's the problem, because a Christianity that's whose goal, or a religion whose goal is to keep our own safety and cleanliness, keep our hands clean, not get too messy, that kind of religion cannot follow Jesus into Jerusalem. And so, what do we do with that? Getting our hands dirty is not a Lenten series, it's the Christian life. That's what it means to follow Jesus. To be a Christian means to confess and to acknowledge that there are things in our souls that are ugly and messy. Things that we usually try and hide and keep at least private. But a Christian says, no, these are there, and opens ourselves up. We pray with the psalmist, search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me. And during this Lenten season, a spiritual director suggests that I practice, not just during Lent, but this ancient practice called examine, which means for me that I many days will spend 15 or 20 minutes at the end of the day asking questions like, when did I sense my emotions kind of going up a few notches? When did I feel anger? When did I feel frustration? When did I feel disappointment or sorrow? And just examining and praying that prayer, search me, O God, and know my heart, and asking God, why? What's at the heart of that? Why did I lash out in this situation? Why did I do this? Why did I think that? Why did I feel this way? And I tell you, it's not a comfortable or clean thing to go let God go down in there and show you some stuff. That's what a Christian does. Lets God into our souls and allows ourselves ultimately then not just to see them ourselves, but even to bring them out in the open so that other people can see our weaknesses and can see our sin and can see our faults as well. A Christian looks around and sees that we have broken relationships. And at the very least, relationships that are incomplete, that are not all of the things that God wants us to do. And a Christian then, in those relationships, thirsts for reconciliation, thirsts for deeper intimacy. In our culture, we have all kinds of different phrases and philosophies that say things like, well, if that person isn't going to do what I want them to do, I don't have time for them. They're a drain on me. I just don't want to deal with that right now. We have all kinds of ways of justifying getting ourselves out of messy relationships. But Jesus walks into Jerusalem. And Jesus even came because we have this broken relationship with God and with each other for that matter. And because God thirsts for reconciliation, Jesus entered into Jerusalem on that Sunday. And a Christian, a follower of Jesus, looks around at a society that is not just in so many ways, and doesn't avoid that fact, doesn't ignore that fact, but acknowledges it and gets dirty. Christians do not get into politics of self-protection, I'm going to vote for whatever benefits me, and I'm going to fight for whatever is in my personal best interest. We don't keep our hands clean by saying, oh, we're all right, and it's those people, those conservatives, Republicans, those liberals, those Democrats, those whoever who are wrong. They're the ones who are messed up. I'm the one who's clean and good. We don't get into politics like that. We don't play that game. We don't stand by and act like we don't participate and benefit from systems in our society that benefit some races at the expense of others. And we acknowledge that most of us in this room are those who benefit from those inequalities of opportunity and all kinds of other things. We're not okay with the fact that our systems, our economic systems, our all kinds of systems benefit the wealthy over the poor. We're not okay with that. I read an article this week that said of America's top biggest corporations, the average difference in the salary, the annual income, not even wealth, but the annual income of a CEO is 345 times the annual income of their lowest paid full-time employee. And we say that's not okay. How is that okay? Is that person 345 times more valuable? Is their work 345 times more important and significant? That's not justice for someone who's making 345 times more than someone to actually make that money at the expense of that other person. And we don't stand by and act like that doesn't happen. It's not okay that we have this global system where some nations exist and flourish at the expense of others. And in so many ways, our great nation has flourished at the expense of others, whether we look at slavery or whether we look a little more recently, where we, as Americans, when our guys are out fighting a war, we say to our desperately poor Mexican neighbors, come have jobs, enter into our nation. But then the second our guys come back from war, we say, get out of here. We don't want you. You're stealing our jobs. We can't say that those things are okay. We can't ignore them or get out of them. We can't ignore the fact and be okay with the fact that we systematically are sucking our God's creation, dry of resources so that we can feed our lusts. And actually to a point where we're not only feeding our lusts but numbing our souls to our need for God. No one benefits from this, and we keep on doing it. See, many of us benefit from all of these systems. Many of us, at least when I say benefit, I mean we get what we want from them and preserve what we want from them. But on Palm Sunday, we have to ask ourselves, are we comfortable singing our happy songs about how Jesus is King and blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord? Are we happy just singing those while Jesus walks into the heart of corruption and death and sin and brokenness? Are we okay allowing that to just happen? And like the crowds, many in the crowd, saying all those things while ignoring how messy it really is to affirm that this Jesus is King. This Jesus is the one who came in the name of the Lord and what it means to follow him. To say these things is the conviction to follow Jesus into the messiness in our souls, into the brokenness of our relationships, into the injustices in our society. Trusting that in those places is where God has hope for us and healing for us and salvation. In those places is where we will find God. It's funny that in things like confession, practices like forgiveness, practices like the work of reconciling broken relationships, practices like seeking justice for the poor and the oppressed. Those are the practices that as Christians we most conveniently and readily avoid. And yet, those are the exact places where Jesus can most consistently be found. That is where we find, in recognizing our sin, in getting involved in the work of reconciling broken relationships, in pursuing justice, that is where we find Jesus. And because that is where we find Jesus, that is where we find hope, that is where we find healing, and that is where we find peace and all of the things our soul searches for. I told you I was a little uncomfortable with where this message went as the week went on. I can also tell you that I, believe it or not, have taken a lot of showers in my life. Believe it or not. And I hope and I pray that all of you have taken a lot of showers in your life. Yes? Please say yes. And from that experience, what I've learned is that the best showers come after a day of good getting your hands dirty work. When your body is caked in mud and sweat and maybe a little blood, and you let the water run over you and you see all the dirt and messiness carried off of you and down the drain, and you feel refreshed and cleansed. Those are the best showers. Sow for yourselves in righteousness. Reap in unfailing love. Break up your unplowed ground, says Hosea. For it is time to seek the Lord, and his righteousness will shower upon you. Get your hands dirty, and you will experience the cleansing, freeing, healing, saving showers of God's righteousness. Let's take a few minutes to reflect before the Lord, and then pray that God will give us the courage to enter into Jerusalem with the one who comes in the name of the Lord.